Hi, everyone. Welcome to my podcast, where I explore the science of health, human performance, and ultimate potential. My name is Dr. Greg Wells, and I'm a scientist with a PhD in human physiology. I have served as a professor in kinesiology at the University of Toronto and as a scientist in translational medicine at SickKids Hospital. I've also worked with dozens of Olympic-level athletes through the Canadian Sports Centre Network. In this podcast, I do my best to take complex research and make it understandable and actionable for you to improve your health and well-being and perform to your true potential at whatever it is that you care about the most. In each show, I chat with leading experts in the field of productivity, sleep, nutrition, physiology, and psychology, as well as some of the most exceptional performers across all disciplines. Together, we explore the amplifiers that propel us towards high performance and overcome the obstacles that challenge us. Ultimately, I want to share 1% gains that can make a massive difference in your life. Thank you for listening in, and I hope that you enjoy this episode. Let me know your thoughts and comments on social at Dr. Greg Wells. All right, let's dive in. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. It's great to see you, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast, where today we will be digging into brain health. We're very fortunate to have Emily Kleonski and Mitchell Kleonski join us today. They are authors of Dementia Prevention, Using Your Head to Save Your Brain. This is a book all about memory loss and dementia risk. This matters a lot to me. My grandmother passed away due to dementia. And so anything that I can learn about easy to follow steps to keep your brain healthy is fascinating for me. And I'm sure will be as well for you, just because brain health is massive. And I know that this is a concern to people across the lifespan. Emily Kleonski, MD, and Mitchell Kleonski, PhD, are a physician and neuropsychologist couple who have cared for their own parents with dementia, created a test used by doctors to measure cognitive function, and treated more than 25,000 patients with cognitive impairment. In dementia prevention, they combine the most current scientific findings about Alzheimer's disease with other dementias and their experience to present a practical guide that empowers you to improve your brain's future. The book doesn't get into any of the fads or unsupported claims of products or fringe theories. Instead, the authors, Emily and Mitch, guide you through a science-based tour of dementia, showing you how the brain works and how its function is affected by everything from blood circulation to blood pressure to glucose levels, vision, and hearing. And also they get into how your physical activity levels, weight, habits, mental outlook, and social engagement also affect your likelihood of developing dementia, which is all of the stuff that we get into in this podcast. So it's sort of like a preview of the book. Really excited to have them on the show. They're fascinating people. They've got a great story, and they're brilliant at deconstructing the science to make it easy for us to take action to improve our brain health. So super psyched to have them here and be able to talk about dementia prevention and explore the new book. All right, without any further delays, please enjoy my conversation with Doctors Emily Kleonski and Mitchell Kleonski, all about using your head to save your brain. Dr. Emily, Dr. Mitchell, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. Great to see you.
Great to see you, Greg.
Good to see you, Greg. Thanks for inviting us.
That's awesome. I'm so excited about your new book, Dementia Prevention, Using Your Head to Save Your Brain. Super cool title. Everyone knows I'm a physiologist. I typically talk about optimization of the body. You talk about optimizing the brain. Those are the highest rated episodes on the show. So we are psyched to have you. How did you end up getting to the point of writing this book? What was the objective? Like, what was your dream? What led to the creation of this book?
It's really a culmination of a really long set of careers in evaluating and treating people who come in usually too late in terms of what's going on with their brain. And so the first 10, 15 years was working with a number of people with moderate dementia. Mild to moderate dementia was the most common kind of entry diagnosis. And then as the word got out that there were things that we could do to at least slow down the course of the dementia, we started seeing people referred to us by physicians in the community at earlier stages. So we started seeing milder and dementias, and also this sort of wake-up call time called mild cognitive impairment, where people are first starting to recognize they're not able to do things the way they used to. And they're aware of it in many cases. In other cases, the people around them are starting to say, you know, that's more than a senior moment. I'm really worried about you. And we found that the things, and Emily's going to talk about what she does medically with these people, which is really important. I do the neuropsychological testing piece of it and the behavioral management piece of it. But what we found is that it worked even better when we saw people earlier. And then we started seeing people where we almost had to fudge the diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment because they wanted it to be covered by their insurance, but they didn't have a real, you know, medical need at that point. And we thought, you know, we can only see so many people in the audience. We want to reach a much wider group of people at a much earlier point in the trajectory of their brain health. And that's what led us to write a book.
I love it. You mentioned that Dr. Emily takes it from a more medical perspective. Emily, do you want to give us a bit of a view of how you ended up in this space and your objectives as
absolutely.
Well?
Absolutely. You know, when I went into medicine, I was 42 years old and I started med school at 1993. And that was the beginning of what we call evidence-based medicine. It's where, you know, it wasn't just your opinion of some expert anymore. It was like, what did the science really say? What did the randomized controlled trial prove or not prove? So that's kind of how I grew up. And I started off as an internal medicine doctor because while I always wanted to be a psychiatrist, I always believed that they didn't know enough medicine. So I went through internal medicine residency training first, practiced for 4 years, then went in and did a psych residency after that. So my entire psych residency was literally spent looking at every single possible reversible cause of dementia. Because by that time, I'd had my entire internal medicine residency plus 4 years of practice. And I was like, wait a second, there's got to be something better out there to do with these patients who had cognitive problems, who were all complicated medically. So I really developed this hit list. Then when I went into my private practice, I set up a huge database that kept track of everything about these patients, what their oxygen levels were when they were in my office, what their oxygen levels were at night when they were sleeping, what their heart rates were, what their homocysteine levels were, what their methylmalonic acid levels were, iron deficiency levels, their vitamin D levels, you name it. If it could be quantified, we put it into the database. And initially, I was sitting there saying to myself, wow, these people are stabilizing their cognition. And I shared that with Mitch, and we looked at the data and figured out, yeah, they really are. So it was a matter of fixing all the things that are fixable, using the dementia-sparing medications that were available. And after the first 4 or 5 years I was in practice medically, we looked at the data, presented it to the American Academy of Neurology in 2014. And what we found was that these people actually improved their cognition after 6 months of this combined approach to treating them. And then their cognition stabilized at that new level, at that improved plateau. The number needed to treat was 6, which is unheard of, because most medications, say for depression, the FDA is thrilled if you know, your number needed to treat is 25. So we were demonstrating great results. So we put that together.
Let me just interject for a second, The other piece of this, I think it's worth pointing out, is that there was a cohort of people who were not getting this approach, but were getting standard care. These are people coming to see me from physicians in the community.
Who didn't come to see me.
And these people, we were also making sure that they got on dementia-sparing medication. So it wasn't as if they weren't getting standard of care. They just weren't getting optimized care. That group separated statistically at a highly significant level in 6 months. There was like a total of about 700 people in these two groups combined. So it wasn't a small sample. They separated statistically at 6 months, and the difference became larger over time because we did this for 2 years. And what the difference became was that the group in standard care slowly but continually got worse. The group in the optimized care stayed the same. And that was not only a step up from where they started, but unchanged at that 2-year point from where they improved to. So I just wanted to point out there.
No, you were absolutely right.
That was a good clarification. Thank you.
Absolutely right. So literally, we took a look at that and recognized the fact that if this is the kind of effect we can have with people who are already demonstrating the disease state, can you imagine what it would be like if we got to put that into practice in the prevention mode? Well, we got helped along by the World Health Organization and by the Lancet Commission, the latter of which published in 2017 and 2020, their list of factors that if you fix these things, you stand a good chance of preventing dementia at the rate of anywhere from 40 to 60% of patients. So what we did was we basically looked at it and said one out of two, 50%.
And we added to it because they had 12 factors. Our model has 20. There's things that they don't focus on that have been added since then, or they just weren't particularly interested in, I guess. Specifically for our sake, one of the most important sort of things that came out of this was the role of oxygen.
Or hypoxia. Mm.
Right.
The absence of oxygen. Not surprising to you as a physiologist.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of my research has been around hypoxia and hypercapnia. I'm actually a respiratory physiologist by training and do mountain climbing and stuff like that. So I like that's my bag. I'm all over it, including breath work. So let's break this into sort of two approaches. I want to hear a little bit about what factors negatively affect the brain. Then we'll talk about what factors positively affect the brain. But beginning with the risk factors, from your perspective, having observed brain health in so many patients over so many years, what factors do you think contribute to cognitive decline? And I'm really interested in like lifestyle factors that are modifiable.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we are going to start with the fact that we've got age-related cognitive decline. And as mammals, everybody is subject to that. So that's right. Something we can't get away from. And then we don't get to pick our parents, and that's not reversible either. So with that as a given, I'll let Mitch go in and talk about the reversible stuff that's lifestyle oriented.
Because basically what I'm going to do is take you through the model that we build in the book with chapter by chapter looking at these. So you're starting with the stuff you can't change. Everything in the rearview mirror, you know, whether you had a head injury from playing sports or were in a motor vehicle accident, whether your parents did not take prenatal vitamins, whether or not you were raised in an abusive environment or next to some chemical plant that was spewing toxins. So putting that behind you, what can you do starting 20s, 30s, 40s, and upward? So the negative factors are things like high blood pressure that's uncontrolled, diabetes that's uncontrolled, sleep apnea that you're unaware of and you're not treating. Those things, of course, factor in with sedentary lifestyle, smoking, excessive alcohol consumption. You also get into, to some extent, and there's tremendous debate about diet. You know, we go back and forth, and you know, there's not just one green leafy vegetable you should eat. There's not like one thing that's going to make a difference. It's a whole bunch of things, but those are really important. Any kind of drug abuse is going to be a problem. In fact, benzodiazepines taken over more than 90 days will cause cognitive decline. It's a risk factor for dementia, particularly as you get older. We're also looking at sensory problems like loss of hearing, loss of vision, the double whammy when someone's got both of those, because these come on very subtly as well. So a lot of times the people we're seeing who don't even know they're having a hearing problem until after the fourth time they ask me to repeat my question, I said, you know, I think you have a problem hearing. And they said, what? And I said, yeah, exactly. That's it. What?
Well, the interesting thing is we always associate, or we tend to associate, loss of hearing with getting older. Interesting study just published a couple of weeks ago that 40-year-olds need to start being checked for hearing loss. Mm-hmm. Because what they're finding is that the earliest stages are appearing in our 40s. And that damage is beginning in your brain in your 40s. So if you want to start thinking about really what to do to protect yourself when you're 70, 80, and 90, and you want to remain intact, you got to start really doing some of this stuff when you're in your 20s, 30s, and 40s.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
Exercise. You know, I wish I exercised in my 30s. The way I exercise today.
Right.
Because not only would I have a better brain, but I would actually have better vision. glaucoma, for instance, is directly tied to a lack of exercise as well as obstructive sleep apnea. So what we did was we put all of these evidence-based factors together in, well, I should say Mitch actually did it because he's the more organized brain than mine, put it together in a model so that the average committed, concerned, intelligent human being would say, look, this is what I've got to look at. This is my checklist. Where am I at on this checklist? Do I need to get my cholesterol under better control? How do I do that? Do I need to get my homocysteine checked? How do I do that? Do I need to go from this like lackadaisical 45-minute easy workout? Maybe my body needs 90 minutes on my stationary bike a day, which is what I do.
Of course, most of the people we see are not even close to that. So we're starting, our formula is, I want you to take a 10-minute brisk walk, and I want you to do it 3 times a day.
Right.
The reason that this works is that most of the time, people, everyone always tells you, oh, exercise, it's wonderful stuff, I really believe in it. But, so I tell them, much to their chagrin or surprise, I say, I want you to examine your butt. And they laugh and they look at me and say, what do you mean? I said, no, no, not that butt. The butt that's in the sentence, I would exercise, but. What comes after that is what you got to focus on. I would exercise, but I don't have the time. I would do it, but it's too difficult. It's too boring. It's something I never did. It's this or that, the other thing. If you break it down into a very small bite, then if you take enough of those bites, you're going to eventually get to everything you need. And that's what we're missing so much. We don't start people at the right place. We set up, oh, look at so-and-so. They ran a marathon at age 60. You look and say, I can't do that. I don't even want to try. I'm going to end up in the physiatrist's office within a week or two. So you got to start small.
Got it. But
the other piece that we missed here was obesity. I call it the third rail of healthcare, because it's now so linked with emotional stuff, shame, and other kinds of factors that a lot of times it's an issue where the doctor sort of mumbles at the corner of his or her mouth, you know, you'll lose a couple of pounds, and that's all they get. And no one really says, okay, how do I do that? And what am I going to do to accomplish that? Give me some guidance here in a way that I can stick with.
So when we think about that, I really like to go back to as early in life as we possibly can. And you've got a highly committed audience to begin with. I'd like to even tweak their brains a bit and get them to think about what they're doing with their children or with their adolescents who they may be raising, not just what they're doing with themselves. So let's focus in on that obesity question. We know that obesity in a pregnant woman is going to affect the cognition of her child. And we've got the data gathered over decades to prove that. We know that children who are overweight actually have poorer test scores and poorer school performance than children who aren't overweight. And those same overweight children turn into lower achieving adults. They have a lower socioeconomic level by the time that they turn into income wage earners.
One of those three.
One of those three.
Income, age, wage earners. There we go. Got it.
Yeah, we got it. So the reality is if you are a parent or you're responsible for a younger person, not just, you know, trying to figure out what you're going to do with your dementing mom, the reality is there's stuff that you need to be able to start doing with the younger people in your life that's going to protect them as well.
I love that. And so let's dig into that a little bit further across the spectrum, whether it's young people, all of us listening today, our parents, my grandmother struggled with dementia and Alzheimer's. So I am 100% genetically predisposed. I'm super interested in this from a personal perspective.
Good.
I'm interested in how we can optimize the brain, reduce our dementia risk, reduce cognitive decline. You mentioned that you found 20 factors. We don't need to get into all of them, but maybe a few of the key ones that you think are critical for us. Then I want to touch on behavior change. But first, let's talk about those 20 risk factors that you think people need to be concerned about. Not risk factors, excuse me, but like modifiable factors in our lives that can actually improve our brain health. Let's pick a few of them that you think are really important and dig into them a little bit.
I would have to say the most important to me is actually hypoxia, is actually oxygen. And the reason is because it is so prevalent and we are so unaware of how it affects people. Let me give you the numbers out of my practice. 82% of the patients who land up in my practice with cognitive impairment are hypoxic, either at rest sitting in my office, walking down the hallway, not even a 6-minute walk, just walking down the hallway, or overnight on a sleep study. Now, I thought, yes, it is eye-popping to hear that number. That is ridiculous because nowhere else has that ever been published. Until we got to the Alzheimer's Association International Conference in 2012, I believe, and a young researcher from Sweden was walking past my data, looked at it, and she said, "I can't believe it. My population is 82% hypoxic too." It was like two sisters. We were like two sisters separated at birth. But it's really an incredible problem, and it's multifactorial. Some of us start off that way at birth. I mean, there are babies who are born who need CPAP.
Yeah.
There are teenagers who are on ADHD medicines because they don't have enough oxygen in their brains when they're sleeping. So we put them on methylphenidate during the day to try and really grind those brains to pay more attention, because an absence of oxygen at night causes you to have impaired executive function, decreased speed of processing, decreased attention, and decreased executive function during the day. So when you get into your 20s, 30s, and 40s, you don't even think, particularly unless you're a very, very overweight person, or unless you've got really bad high blood pressure, your doctor's not going to be paying attention to whether you've got sleep apnea or not. But every single time you go to sleep at night and you are not getting air down that airway and oxygen onto those red blood cells into your brain, you are causing brain cell death. It's that simple. Mitch uses the analogy, it's like putting a pillow over somebody's face like five times an hour or 20 times an hour. Nobody wants to be that asphyxiated, but that's what's happening. It's complicated a little bit because women are a bit protected because we've got that estrogen thing going on till we hit 42 and become premenopausal. That happens, and we develop the same risk factor as men do. And so we equalize, and by the time that we are 60, virtually one out of two people have obstructive sleep apnea that, for the most part, is undetected, undiagnosed by their doctor. Mm-hmm. So if there is one takeaway message that somebody picks up and reads our book and says, "I need to have my oxygen level checked at night," that would be it. Because when we fix that, we notice the cognition improving over that 6-month period. The other interesting thing happens, you can take a look at the MRI scans that can actually measure the parts of the brain that are affected, say, by Alzheimer's disease, the hippocampus and the frontal areas in the brain, and you will see increases in the size of those parts of the brain when you fix somebody's hypoxia. So to me, it's fix the lack of oxygen. If there was only going to be one thing I'd do. Mitch, what's yours?
Mitch, what do you think?
I would use one thing because they're all interrelated. One of the points we make is that, and I know it doesn't fit well into a soundbite, but the answer is that it's all these factors interacting. Take the hypoxia. If you're not breathing well while you're sleeping, chances are you're not sleeping well also. So then you are also getting up to go to the bathroom multiple times. Turns out nocturia is related to sleep apnea. Well, then you go to your doctor, says, "I keep getting up to pee in the middle of the night." Doctor says, "Here's a medication that's going to dry you up." So they give you an anticholinergic medication. Wonderful thing for your bladder, but it also depletes your brain of acetylcholine. Well, all the three out of the four memory medications we're using are procholinergic. We're trying to increase the acetylcholine in the brain. So now you got two problems. One, you're not really sleeping any better. You're just not wetting your bed. Two, you've now got this medication which is drying you out. as well as depleting you of acetylcholine. Plus, you're tired. Who wants to exercise when they're tired?
Absolutely.
Or you may say, you know, I need something to pick me up. Well, maybe I'll take some, you know, I'll just do a lot of other things. Like maybe I'll eat some very sugary foods. That'll give me a boost. So now you're adding on the pounds and you're not exercising. So now you're gaining weight. Again, all these things keep going back and forth and intertwined. The key is start someplace. Sometimes it's the sleep study. Sometimes it's the exercise. Sometimes it's changing our diet. It's definitely, it's not smoking. It's, you want to get rid of that right away because that's always a big driver. 2 alcoholic beverages a day. No matter which study you read, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
0 to 1, 1 to 2. It depends on what you read these days as to whether it's good or bad or indifferent. But more than 2, you should drink less. And you should not pour like I do.
Yeah, nice. That's awesome. Earlier you mentioned, I know I need to exercise, but, and it's funny, you joked about the word, but I just spent the entire last week with a buddy of mine who's a colorectal surgeon. We talked a lot about butts as we were going about our fun activities for the week. But in this case, we'll talk about the excuse related but, and not to, there's no blame, there's no shame, there's none of that. It's just like, this is the reality of the challenges that we face in our life. I'm curious about, how do we change our habits to optimize our health and get rid of those but in our sentences when it comes to healthy eating, better sleep, more exercise, all of these habits that we can use to cultivate this life where our bodies are optimized, our brains are optimized. What have you seen in terms of people who have been successful in making these changes long-term?
First of all, an understanding that we are constantly needing to adapt to change in our lives. We know this as kids. We know when we're raising kids. But so many of us get into midlife and say, well, that's it. I'm all done. Stick a fork in me. However, there's those other third stages in life past midlife that also require adaptation, and we have to make changes. So that's the first thing is, you know, it's okay. I don't have to be perfect. I do need to be open to the idea that I need to evolve. So that's the first step. The second step is choosing reasonable steps. I did an article on New Year's resolutions, why they fail. Well, it turns out that one of the reasons is they're not specific enough and they don't focus on process. Someone says, I'm going to eat healthier. Say, wow, that sounds great. So what exactly does that mean? Until they get to the point where saying, I'm only going to eat at mealtime, and I'm going only to eat during these hours, I am going to limit my carbohydrates to this much, or I'm going to only eat these kinds of foods, I'm going to eat on smaller plates, I'm going to not put 2 servings on the same platter, I'm going to be aware of what I'm eating, and then look at the process of doing that. So you have to have a reasonable goal because you can't lose all that weight overnight and you can't suddenly eat, change everything you're eating and make it successful because you're going to start craving it. Mm. You got to focus on the process. And the other thing you got to do is every once in a while, you got to have a day where you splurge.
Right.
Where you just say, so, you know, Emily's taught me that where, you know, we may be on a no, low carbohydrate diet for about a month and we lose a certain amount of weight, then we say, okay, this is carb blowout day. Mm-hmm. We'll just eat anything we want for the one day.
Yeah.
And then we go back to what we were eating before for the dietary change on those other days. So you really have to have a long-term plan. It's a short-term focus, but it's got to fit into, okay, I got to reboot here. And we also have to give people permission to screw up. So you say to yourself, you know, I stopped doing what I didn't exercise today. Or I ate the wrong things, or last night I really did drink too much. That doesn't mean that my plan is over and done with. It just means I need to reboot it. I need to restart it again. Mm-hmm. It's like when my cable goes out, I got to unplug it for 10 seconds and plug it back in.
Dr. Emily, what about you?
Well, whatever, and we all know ourselves the best and we know how we like to play hide and seek with who we are and what we really need. So there may be somebody who needs to write something down. For instance, if it's taking that first step toward exercise or increasing the amount of exercise that they're doing, it's How much do you want to increase it by? Putting it on a note card, a 3x5 card, tacking it on the front of the mirror that they see a couple of times a day, every time they're in there. And maybe it's putting a check mark and a date that that's the day that you did that extra 30 minutes on the stationary bike, or that you walked that extra 30 minutes. So you've got some kind of a physical reinforcement of whatever that specific goal is, until it gets to the point where you don't need to give yourself the pat on the back with that physical reinforcement on that particular item that you're trying to get better. But by going through that physical act of keeping track, starting with what your goal is, keeping track of what you're doing on a daily basis, you can actually see that I can achieve this. I can do this. And if it's a matter of exercise, you're going to eventually see the difference in the scale. For people who are trying to lose weight, I absolutely advocate getting on the scale first thing every single morning. It's just something that we've got to do. I was not born naturally thin. I came from a family where all the Italian women on my mother's side of the family were all 5'1" and weighed like 250 pounds. So I know that genetically, I've got a problem. I'm one of these people, I can look at the donut in the inside of a box and put weight on. So for me, it's a matter of every single day of my life, whether I like it or not, I have got to hit that stationary bike. For other people, say trying to give up smoking, it's not a matter of going from my 3-pack-a-day habit that I had in 1987, because that's what I did in 1987, to zero smoking. It was a matter of cutting down one or two cigarettes every single day. So it's making the goal achievable, making it physical, and patting yourself on the back, because nobody else is going to do it for you.
Yeah, I love that little bit of, you know, pat yourself on the back, give yourself some props and some credit, love yourself first, which then enables you to love, you know, everybody else that much more. Congratulations on getting this book done. I've loved this conversation. I'm sensitive to your time. The book is called Dementia Prevention, Using Your Head to Save Your Brain. If people want to learn more about you both and your work and get a copy of the book, where can they go online to find out more about you?
The book is already up for pre-order on Amazon and barnesandnoble.com. Johns Hopkins University Press is where you can get it as well. It's also going to be on audiobook. It's also going to be translated into Russian, it turns out, and possibly some other languages. So for the Russian speakers out there in your audience, they can get that. That will be for a year or two. But it's going to be April 4th. It's coming out. And we're hoping that a lot of people are going to be really interested enough to get it, read it, use it is really going to be the most important thing, using it.
Yeah, my book comes out on April 4th as well. So we are both doing a book launch on the exact same day. So that's pretty exciting for all of us.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you very much.
What's the title of yours?
It's called Powerhouse. It's right there on the shelf. I got it an hour ago, so I'm super excited. So we're all in this together. So anything I can do to help all of you, I'm super excited to do it, because I know how hard it is to get a book across the finish line. So congratulations, you two. I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your expertise with us, keeping us healthy long-term. And it's been an honor to have you on the show.
Thank you for having us. Thanks. Been really great being with you. And I'll be reading your book.
Right on. We'll definitely get those back and forth after this is over.
Excellent.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Dr. Greg Wells podcast. If you found this show informative and helpful, check out my blog at drgregwells.com for additional insights and resources on health and human performance. I update the blog a couple times a month. To stay up to date on the latest tips, articles, and videos, be sure to follow me on social at Dr. Greg Wells. My goal on social is to keep your health and wellness and positivity at the forefront of your mind, and so I would be thrilled to connect with you there. If you found this episode helpful, please consider subscribing to the podcast. That helps us out a ton. And leave a review. Your feedback is greatly appreciated and helps me to continue to produce valuable content that's relevant to all of you. Please feel free to share this episode with your friends and community. That helps a ton as well. And that brings this week's show to an end. I look forward to seeing you in the next episode. Have a great week, everyone.